from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of the new exhibit Art for the Nation at the Indiana State Museum.
Then I'll learn about a production of Hamlet based on a script that most of us have never read.
And I'll go on location at the Palladium to find out how do you tune a performance hall. Plus there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Imagine a time when there were no pop-up ads, the internet hadn't been dreamed of yet, and there was no television. That was the world during World War I and World War II, and the U.S. government took advantage of the lack of clutter to create poster art to encourage the nation to buy war bonds and modify behavior. Sharon Gamble spoke with Catherine Gould, who curates cultural history for the Indiana State Museum, and Kathy Moore, communications director for the museum, about the new exhibit, Art for the Nation.
Art for the Nation is a touring exhibition, yes?
It was actually created in-house by our exhibition staff.
Oh, really?
And with me as the curator, yes.
Oh, wonderful. And are there plans to tour it after it's done at your place?
Well, there are preliminary plans to design a traveling component from the show. The original posters will not be able to travel because they are paper and rather fragile, but high-quality reproductions can be made of the posters, and they can travel in various sizes to other institutions. We were kind of thinking along the lines of public libraries, local historical societies, other small museums in Indiana.
Where'd the idea for this exhibition come from?
Well, I'm the curator of our war bond poster collection at the State Museum, and I've always wanted to do something with it. My initial idea was something kind of decorative along the lines of a bridge show, since they are so beautiful and stunning looking. And then the opportunity came to fill a gallery with an exhibition, and I said, well, let's do these posters. We have most of the ones that we need in-house. The exhibit is also using loans from the collections of the Indianapolis Marion County Public Library and from the collection of the National Headquarters of the American Legion. So we were very fortunate to have some really, really good resources here in town of different collections of posters. So just from using that source of material there, I thought we could really do a really wonderful exhibition that not only looks at the posters, but also kind of looks at Indiana on the home front as well.
And we do seem to have a rich history. Help us, for those of us who've maybe gone a few years since we studied the history of World Wars I and II here, how did we factor in on a national scale? Were we a fairly important place for war bond tours? Did we raise more money per capita? I'm sensing that we were a pretty responsible state.
From all that I've uncovered in my research, Indiana exceeded every one of its war bond quotas. Each war bond drive ran for a certain number of weeks, and each state had a quota that it needed to meet in terms of total sales. Indiana exceeded all of its quotas. In World War I, we sold over $500 million in bonds, and in World War II, we sold over $3 billion in war bonds, just in Indiana alone.
Oh, my gosh.
Which kind of gives you an idea for that's one state out of then 48 states, so you can understand the scale of the cost of the war.
And not a highly populated state either. I mean, we sometimes lose track of that being here in the capital and thinking, 1.3 to 1.5 million people. But we're not a very populous state.
We were still quite rural at the time.
Yeah.
And then in terms of war bond rallies, that's actually a rather interesting question because the first war bond rally in the nation in World War II was held here on January 15th, 1942 in Indianapolis. And it was attended by Carol Lombard, a Fort Wayne native who was the wife of Clark Gable.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very successful rally. Again, the first in the nation.
How did we get selected to be first?
I don't quite know that answer. I don't know the circumstances around it. If it has something to do with Carol Lombard, I'm not quite sure.
And was that the tour after which...
Yes. She left Indianapolis and was flying back to Hollywood with her mother and another number of other folks on a plane, and it unfortunately did crash, and all aboard were killed.
Wow. You know, it occurs to me that we might have listeners who don't know what a war bond is, especially if their parents, grandparents, older relatives never talked about that. Let's back up and say, what is a war bond, and what is the money used for?
Right. Well, the war bond was essentially a way for the citizens to loan its money to the government for a period of time, at which point then it would be paid back with interest. So you were basically helping to fund the war directly with cash. And the war was one of the big funders of the war were these war bonds. And it was for a way for the government to just bring money in, bring cash in, because the mobilization for war was such an enormous effort. It cost so very much money that it needed more than what it had. And so basically, the American public was loaning its money to the government for this purpose with the intention that in, say, 5-10 years, it would be paid back with interest.
And since the economy wasn't, when you're at war, it's not that strong, you know, you really have to work hard to sell people on the idea of buy this bond. I mean, certainly the carrot on the stick was it will be paid back with interest at some point. But what were some of the... you know, looking back on it, we probably can label it propaganda, but it wouldn't have really been called propaganda. It would have been called what? Motivational literature? And
yeah.
Sales? Posters?
The posters, which is what makes this show that we have so appealing, so interesting, because it's history and art together.
Mm-hmm.
You learn so much through the art.
Right. The posters actually had several intentions to them. They needed to boost morale, and also indoctrination would be one of their goals. And by that I mean convincing Americans of the government's war aims, what it was doing, and why it was doing it, why it was just and necessary. But also education. The reasons for going to war needed to be taught to the American people so they understood, and the reasons for the sacrifices that they were being asked needed to be understood. Why were you being asked to plant a victory garden? Why was that so important for me to grow my own food instead of continuing to buy it as I had been? Why was it important to recycle scrap metal? Why was it important to donate blood to the Red Cross or any
number of things?
Support
women working in the factories.
Correct. So they were also a method of instruction. The word propaganda, I find, is actually quite interesting because to some people it has just an immediate negative connotation to it. But that's in this exhibition, I really don't want to judge that.
Right.
I want people to kind of come to it and ask questions. And actually, if they can leave asking more questions than they've had answered, then I think I'll have done a successful job. I really want the visitors to kind of examine that relationship between art and politics and look at how patriotism was used as a tool of propaganda to persuade the public to do certain things. I want them to think critically about the historical evidence and object interpretation. As beautiful as these posters are, they are just covered with layers and layers and layers of meaning in all of the different images and the slogans that were used. Any one poster in this exhibition can be dissected for hours.
Well, it's a marketing study even.
Right.
You know, marketing takes into account fonts and colors and you know, the people that are chosen to put into that poster, you know, a little blonde child going, you know, because they're scared, and just all kinds of different things like that are the layers that she's saying. It's just, it's a study in marketing even.
Yeah, the images were very well crafted. The slogans used were very well worded. Everything was considered. Each individual poster was intending to elicit a very specific response. It wanted to trigger a particular emotion in you, whether it was fear, whether it was hatred, anxiety, patriotism, and it really wanted you to do a very specific thing: recycle, travel less, join the military, work harder, work longer, buy more war bonds. So it was really there was an intention behind everything in these posters. Now, by World War II, it did become a little bit more professionalized.
That's one of the things I'm curious about. What changes you see between the campaigns and the posters of World War I, fast forward to World War II? A lot has changed.
Right. One thing is they were a little bit more romanticized in World War I. I really don't want to say naive, but they did have this kind of idealistic feel to them about military service, about going to war. By World War II, it had really become a government agency, professionalized. Madison Avenue got involved, and everything was very, very much regimented in terms of message, image, slogan.
Target markets.
Yes.
More sophisticated use of reaching these people as opposed to these people.
Correct.
The thing we always forget is that nobody in World War I called it World War I. It was the war.
Right.
It was the one and only World War that was ever going to be fought. It was the Great War.
Great War.
Yeah. So it's only with these glasses that we can put on and look backwards that we see that. Kathy, put on your marketing background hat, and I know you have deep history in both the for-profit and the not-for-profit worlds. What are a couple of the posters that you see that even by today's standards you just say, "Whoa, that's
shocking!"
Shocking.
There are some that are very shocking. There are some that show German soldiers dragging little children behind them, and that's what Catherine was saying. They are made to create that emotion, and I can't imagine the government releasing posters like that in this day and age and getting away with it. I just don't think that it would happen anymore. So, you know, we look at all these nice little blonde children and families all dressed up in red, white, and blue, and, you know, all these perfect little scenarios that they've created in some of these. And then they're contrasted with the other ones that have the soldiers with bulging muscles carrying flags flying in the breeze behind them and, you know, patriotism all the way. And it's just really fascinating to me to see these posters because they're so beautiful with the colors and, you know, again, the fonts that they've used and the sayings that they've put on them are just so interesting, but every one has such an interesting story beyond that you can really delve into the whys. You know, why was it done this way? Or, you know, isn't it funny that this one has this perfect little world, whereas this one has this German soldier dragging a child behind him? And, you know, they're all part of the whole picture. So it does make for a really interesting show. I think this is a show that my in-laws would be very interested in, for instance. He fought in World War II, and I think that this would be very familiar to them. They will remember these posters. So I can see a lot of seniors coming to a show like this. But on the other hand, I can see my daughter, who is in marketing and public relations now, I can see her being very interested in this too, because it is such an interesting study in marketing.
It's not right to say it was the social media of the time, but it was a mass communication system.
Was, yes.
Where were most of these posters deployed? Where were they? Where could we have seen them?
They would have been anywhere, and that was one of the main reasons that posters were so very successful. They were fairly cheap to produce. They were very easy to distribute, and they could have been anywhere: in schools, libraries, storefronts, post offices, billboards, park benches, on little stands outside of your office, They were in factory lunchrooms. They were anywhere you could possibly imagine to put a poster.
Hmm. What do we know?
Well, remember back, excuse me, but back in those, in the 1940s and such, for instance, you weren't bombarded with advertising like we are today.
True.
You know, you can't pick a pen up or, you know, look anywhere without seeing an advertising message now. But back in the 40s, that just wasn't the case. You know, you didn't have television commercials, and you didn't have radio beating commercials into your head,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
you certainly didn't have the internet and billboards and things. It just, there was so much more of a limited source of messages like that.
Which made these messages stand out more.
It made them stand out so much more, right.
And in fact, the poster that Kathy referred to a little earlier with the Hun dragging the child behind her is actually a poster called Remember Belgium, and it's green and black, with the Hun silhouetted in black dragging the young child behind her. And the title is Remember Belgium, and it was a reference to an incident of the German army when it invaded Belgium. There were a lot of reports, most false, of the raping and pillaging going on. And it actually created quite a story in the press in and of itself. And so the person who designed the poster took that from the media, from the news stories and, you know, the reports of atrocities, and created this poster.
Sharon Gamble with Catherine Gould, who curates cultural history for the Indiana State Museum, and Kathy Moore, communications director for the museum. You can go to the new exhibit, Art for the Nation, from January 29th through July 24th. For more information, go to indianamuseum.org. Again, indianamuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Few audiences have had the pleasure of seeing Shakespeare's first Hamlet until now. IUPUI's Hoosier Bard Productions and the Indy Fringe Theater are presenting Young Hamlet this February for the first time in Indianapolis. Travis DiNicola spoke with Terry Burris, Associate Professor of English Drama and the Director and General Editor of the IUPUI New Oxford Shakespeare Project, as well as Professor Gary Taylor of Florida State University, a noted Shakespearean scholar and Senior Director of the New Oxford Shakespeare and producer of Hoosier Bard's production.
Help me understand this. This is an early draft of Hamlet? Is that sort of what this is? I mean, this is actually, this is Shakespeare. This isn't someone going in and you know, writing a new version of Hamlet or something like that. Is that correct? I mean, help me understand it historically and where this comes from.
Yes, well, it's the earliest surviving version of the play. So it's
okay.
Not somebody writing a new play,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Ophelia's Revenge. It's
It's
the old play. In fact, it's the oldest version of the play that we have. And when it was first rediscovered in the 19th century, people were very excited because they thought they'd found Shakespeare's first version of the play.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 20th century, most scholars thought, well, great writers never have to rewrite their work. They get it right the first time, so it couldn't possibly be Shakespeare's first version of the play. It just has to be a bad text.
Mm-hmm.
And so people stopped
An early draft that he tossed out or something.
People just stopped paying attention to
it.
And late in the 20th century, that kind of attitude became less and less credible and less accepted by scholars.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are beginning to look at some of these very early texts more seriously. And Terry Burris has mm-hmm. been looking at Hamlet in particular. And but really the only way that you can test these theories is mm-hmm. in the theater, because
sure.
Shakespeare was a very good playwright. And so if this is Shakespeare's own version, it's a version that should work in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, in fact, that Hamlet was really successful in the theater from about the time that Shakespeare was 24 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be a version, it might have been his first play, this would be a version that Shakespeare wrote when he was very young, and when the company, the actors that he was working with, were young, were hungry, were not already established, famous,
So you're saying that this was almost certainly actually performed.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. Okay, so the idea being, so it was performed, and then, but we don't know at this point, I mean, what prompted Shakespeare to go back and to create the old version, or the rewritten, or older, or
well,
the one that we know?
We have lots of theories.
Yeah.
Theories abound on this play because we do have those three surviving printed versions of the text. And but this, as Gary said, it would have been the first printed text, printed in 1603, which would make it the oldest. But in another way, it's the newest. Because if it is Shakespeare's text, and this play was certainly performed in the theater, the title page of the 1603 version of the play says that it was played in the universities of Oxford and Cambridge and in the city of London. So the title page itself announces it as a play that was in rep.
So, I mean, just to make maybe a comparison that isn't totally fair, but to put in more of a modern context, I mean, right now, Spider-Man on Broadway is going through previews, and they've delayed the opening until March, and when it opens in March, that will be the final official text. But all the different versions that are going now, you know, theoretically a historian, you know, a couple hundred years from now could go back and find different ones with different endings and so on as they're sort of workshopping. Is that similar?
No, the difference here is that this version of the play ran in the theater a long time. That the difference in the dating of these, the version that people know was written 13 years or more after this version.
Wow, okay, there's that much of a gap.
And so one of the reasons that the version that people know is different is that by that point, Shakespeare's lead actor was in his mid-30s. So having Hamlet as a character who's 18, 19 years old didn't make so much sense anymore.
I see.
And
so it is a young Hamlet in that.
Oh yes, it
is.
This is a young Hamlet, not only because it was written by a young playwright, but it's about a Hamlet who's 18, 19 years old. So it's like, you know,
Well, let's
it's
let's
a
talk
very
about
different
that.
Perspective on the play.
Sure, let's talk about
teenager.
The recalcitrant teenager. Yes,
the differences between this young Hamlet and the Hamlet that most of us are familiar with. How is it different? I mean, obviously the recalcitrant teenager and so on, but
it's as a play, it's much more physical play.
Okay.
It's not as deeply philosophical or psychological. There's none of the Freudian introspective Hamlet. He's he's a very he's a young man who sees the ghost of his father and is commanded to revenge the most foul and unnatural murder, and he moves right to it.
Action.
You don't sit there and think a lot about whether or not we should do this.
Okay.
He is moving very quickly. So we have a cast who they are young and they are physical, stage, combat, dance, and music all involved, because we want it to be as fast as we as the words on the text demand that it be a very direct revenge play.
Do you notice a difference in the writing? I mean, obviously a 16-year difference, you know, is going to be substantial in some ways. But you say that the words on the page are fast. I mean, does it read faster actually than later work? Or?
Right. If you have the very famous soliloquy, to be or not to be, that is the question. That's replaced by to be or not to be, marry, there's the point, and on it goes very quickly. It echoes the more familiar Hamlet, but it is not that more familiar Hamlet.
And there are parts of the story that are different, and there some of the characters have different names, and some of the things that we expect to happen in the play, because all of us know the more familiar version. I mean, that's true of scholars, too. And so part of the pleasure of this, and for me, of seeing it develop in performance and in rehearsal, is to discover the differences, and the differences in the characterization, and why... you know, this way of doing it makes sense in terms of that earlier story. So that, and one of the problems with Shakespeare, more generally, is that he's an obligation for most people, but he's also, Hamlet has been in the repertoire continuously for four centuries. So people, they already know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so that there's a sense of it as not being news. Well, this version of the play is news. It was news in its own time. It made an impression in its own time for a young playwright from nowhere,
mm-hmm.
from Stratford, you know. Mm-hmm. That's like Tipton, or, you know.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
From
a small town, small rural town, mm-hmm. who made it to the big city. The big city, right. London, mm-hmm. In Shakespeare's time, was a smaller town than Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
It had a smaller population.
Sure.
All these great plays were written for a town mm-hmm. that is a smaller town than Indianapolis. So that's that sense of discovery, and I've seen this watching this company work with the play, their sense of excitement. I'm not performing. I'm not directing, so I'm just an observer. Their sense of excitement and discovery with something that, you know, you sort of dread Shakespeare. A lot of people, and mm-hmm. and so it, there's a big sense of excitement.
Well,
about
tell
it.
Me about this production and the cast and the yeah. group, because this is part of Hoosier Bard.
That's right.
So tell me, well, first about that. It's a Hoosier Bard production, right. And then we'll talk specifically about this upcoming production.
Absolutely. Hoosier Bard is part of our IUPUI English drama. We are, and it's also part of, and more importantly, part of the New Oxford Shakespeare
mm-hmm.
That is being edited in part at IUPUI, where we've gotten an incredible amount of support from the administration and the campus and the community. So in order to edit these plays from a theatrical perspective, mm-hmm. it's best if we can experiment with them on stage. And so as we edit, for example, I'm editing this play right now,
mm-hmm.
and so to have it staged helps me to see what I'm reading, helps me to see it in
action. Interesting. So it's performance as research, then?
It's performance as research. It's very much experimental. Mm-hmm. It also falls back on what we talked about before, original stage practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we want to do, we want to reach out from the campus and into the community. And so we have actors who are students at IUPUI,
mm-hmm.
and we've got actors who are community actors, and we've got equity actors who live in and work in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And we are performing it at the Indianapolis Fringe or Indy Fringe Theater.
Right.
And so in that way, we're bridging the campus and the community. A campus on the edge of a city that is so dynamic and growing, like Indianapolis, and has such a fabulous art scene, demands really at this point a very strong campus presence, theater, theater presence on campus.
Tell me how the actors are responding to this.
They're very, the energy level, I can
I mean, all of us know the actual version or the, mm-hmm. the other version. What are you referring to it now as?
Referring to it as the old man's version.
The old man's version. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, the old man's version.
So, you know, I mean, all of your actors know that version. So, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, in a sense, they almost have to, you know, unlearn it and relearn it, I would imagine. But, I mean, how are they reacting to this? I would imagine most of them probably were not familiar with the young Hamlet script until this production.
They were not. They were not mm-hmm. familiar with this script. So through the reading, during readings, they were surprised at the change in the language.
Mm-hmm.
And they found it really exciting. And they tell me all the time how they look forward to coming to rehearsals every day. We're rehearsing every single night, and except for Fridays and Saturdays. Sunday through Thursday, we're there in the theater. And remember, in this script, there's no reference to Hamlet being 30 years old.
Okay.
The gravedigger never says that Hamlet is 30. Hamlet is clearly a very young Hamlet.
An impulsive, and it sounds like.
He's a troubled teen.
Yeah.
Only really seriously troubled. And this makes a lot more sense of the relationship between him and Ophelia. They're mm-hmm. both, you know, teenagers, and they have some of the volatility mm-hmm. of people at that age, and so that it's a young people's play. There are older people in the cast. There are their parents, and there are mm-hmm. interactions between a person going through that kind of stage of their life with older people who don't understand them, quite literally.
And I can see how this makes the play make a lot more sense in some ways.
It makes the play make a lot more sense in terms of the dynamics of the family. And but also, I can say this again because Terry won't, but Terry is herself, you know, an equity actor, a professional dancer, a professional singer, as well as a professional Shakespeare scholar who works in the very technical area of editing Shakespeare's works. So she brings such a palette of different kinds of expertise to the project, to so that, you know, she's up there acting with them. Rather than
as she's directing.
Yes, exactly. She's directing.
Before we wrap this up, tell me just a bit about the actor you have playing Hamlet.
A wonderful young man from Birmingham, England, trained at the University of Birmingham. His name is Tom Cardwell. He's from a theater family in England. He married Kat Cardwell, Catherine Cardwell, who's the assistant director, and went to Indiana University. And Kat Cardwell heard about the New Oxford Shakespeare, wanted to be a part of it, and married Tom and brought him back to Indianapolis. So we have in the city a brand new, fantastic talent.
Great.
And Tom is a Hamlet that is truly a Hamlet you will never forget.
Travis DiNicola with Professors Terry Burris and Gary Taylor. Young Hamlet will be performed at the Indy Fringe on February 4th, 5th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. Again, next month on the 4th, 5th, 10th, 11th, and 12th. For more information, visit IndieFringe.org, IndieFringe.org.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
So what piano player would you like to hear this weekend?
Andre Watts. I get it.
That was really
was
But you know what?
Terrible.
Wouldn't it be great to have him come in and he could help us say
what
will we do?
It
just keeps getting worse
and
worse. Yeah. Anyway, so it is our calendar recall. What'll we do? And Andre Watts is in town this weekend performing the Emperor Concerto with the Indianapolis Symphony, part of the Lilly Classical Series, Friday, Saturday night. It should be a lot of fun. I'm looking
and
forward to it.
And hearing that is a bright idea.
Oh, aren't you clever?
Hey, speaking of music, there's plenty of it on tap this weekend at where? The Palladium. It's finally
time.
We all get to go in and hear it at 10 o'clock. If you're hearing us on Saturday afternoon, I hope you were there this morning. But if you're hearing us on Friday night, put it on your calendar. Get up. Go up to the Palladium. 10 o'clock. The doors open to the public. There's a ribbon-cutting ceremony at 11. A free concert by Carmel Brass Choir, which includes a premiere performance of the Palladium Suite composed by Carmel resident Scott Jurek. And then the rest of the afternoon is Community Day with back-to-back musical performances on the Palladium stage. So you can just drop in, out, and hear everything from vocal jazz to chamber music to everything in between.
It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a great day. And also, I would encourage listeners to listen to the rest of our The Matters today, because after our calendar and then the break, we'll come back and you've got a piece where you got to walk around the Palladium and find out how do they tune a concert
hall. It was fascinating. And one of the things I learned that that I wasn't able to capture on tape is that there's only so far, you know, we live in a digital age, and yet there's only so far computer technology will take you. At some point, no matter how accurate a computer model is, you have to trust human ears.
There is an art to it.
There is.
Absolutely.
What
I am looking forward
on?
Very much to I was able to get there for one of the tuning concerts earlier. It was a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to going back.
It's a
now
gorgeous space.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Hey, another great thing to hear is coming up at the Indie Acoustic Cafe series, which continues down at their performance space down in Fountain Square. And Darden Smith is coming on January 29th. He's from Austin, Texas. He is a fantastic singer, songwriter, really just a great voice, great performer. I had a chance to see him one of the last times he was in town, and so much fun. If you love really good, you know, sort of acoustic, rock, folk, Just great, strong music. Check out Darden Smith. You can get more information at IndieAcousticCafeSeries.com. What's really nice about this whole series that's been put together by Mark Butterfield is it's not like a bar setting. This is a setting for a concert by acoustic musicians. So people really sit down and listen, though you can't get a beer if you want. But a lot of fun. Definitely worth checking out.
Travis and beer. I've never heard those two in the same sentence before. Speaking of things that you don't hear together often, by the way, that was totally a joke. We like our beer here. We should get somebody to brew an Art of the Matter special brew.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Ooh. Hey, two names you wouldn't necessarily say in the same breath regularly will be paired on a concert on Sunday the 30th at 4 o'clock at Trinity Episcopal Church, which is at 33rd and Meridian Streets. It's a free concert. It is part of the Meridian Song Project series. Stephen Stolen, gorgeous tenor. I hope you listen to his program here on WFYI Radio. He is doing music by Elvis Costello. Yes, that one, Elvis Costello. I know, it's interesting. The Juliet Letters, which is actually something Elvis Costello put together. That is inspired by the writings of an academic who had an interest in Verona and the virtual nonstop mail to the Shakespearean fictional character Juliet. If you saw the film Letters to Juliet, you have something of the idea here. And Elvis Costello actually created a full-length concert piece that blends the pop music that he's famous for with some classical touches, and the local Alexander String Quartet will be performing with Stephen Stolen. So Letters to Juliet, if that intrigues you, put it on your calendar for Sunday, January 30th, 4 o'clock, Trinity Episcopal Church, and it's free.
Wow, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah, leading up to Valentine's Day.
There are a ton of things going on at Heron's School of Art and Design this weekend, a bunch that opens on January the 21st on Friday and continues on. Just to give you sort of a heads up, especially because these are all going on through the next month or so, Curious and Curiouser explores the work of three artists, Casey Riordan Millard, Wayne White, and Sarah Emerson, who basically make kind of work using cute subjects, but it's a lot more than that. Much more than cute.
Some
really interesting work. And also, the show Impractically Political Epicenter, an exhibition of John Hitchcock's printmaking work, is going on through February 10th. And then A Fire in My Belly, David Wojnarowicz. I know I'm probably not pronouncing that exactly correctly, but this is the filmmaker whose film was recently removed from a Smithsonian exhibition, and they are showing it at the Heron School of Art and also having discussions about it and an exhibition about it. And all that goes on now through into February. Definitely worth checking out at Heron School of Art and Design.
Lots to see and do and think about. Travis, I know you you somewhat follow the local belly dance scene.
Well, it's hard to follow when it moves, but you know, I do what I can.
Speaking of fire in the belly, the belly dancers,
wow.
Yes, that's real,
okay.
Will be performing later this month at the Athenaeum Theater. That's going on January 28th at 7 o'clock, and it's part of a performance called the Rivoli Review. Why is it called that if it's at the Athenaeum?
The Rivoli. Why is the Rivoli going over the Athenaeum?
Well, because the Rivoli desperately needs renovation, and this is a fundraiser for the renovation of that fabulous East Side Theater. So Rivoli Review at the Athenaeum on January 28th at 7 o'clock. And just all kinds of fun, including the burlesque troupe Creme de la Femme. belly dancers and Creme de la Femme. How can you go wrong?
Let's shift gears entirely here. The Decorators Show preview tours are coming up.
Whoa.
January 29th and 30th. So next weekend from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 43rd and Meridian Street. It's a $5 cost. It's your chance to see this year's Decorators Show House before it undergoes its transformation by some of Indiana's most creative designers. And what's really cool is this is the 50th anniversary of the show house. So this is the oldest continuously running Decorators Show House in the country. Check it out next weekend, 29th and 30th, 10 to 5. Go up 43rd and Meridian and see the house before. I'm sure it's pretty fantastic before as well.
Phil Olson is a playwright who's written a comedy, A Nice Family Gathering, which one of our colleagues on a syndicated NPR program described as Garrison Keillor meets Topper by way of Fargo. I'm going to say that again. Garrison Keillor meets Topper by way of Fargo.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that one.
Uh-huh. So here's the deal. A family patriarch never got around to telling his wife of 35 years he loved her. If you have a sweetie in your life, let that be a hint to you. But this guy never got around to telling his wife of 35 years he loved her. He returns as a ghost to the first Thanksgiving Day gathering since his death, meaning to tell his wife that he loves her, only to discover that she has brought a date.
What?
Oh, uh-oh. Comedy ensues. As they say, it's a nice family gathering. And it opens January 27th and runs through February 6th. It is a production of the Carmel Community Players at the Carmel Community Playhouse, which is up there in Clay Terrace.
Cool.
Nice Family Gathering, it's called.
Hey, one of the shows that I would really love to get to see on Broadway or in London that's been going on
Spider-Man?
Is... Well, yes, Spider-Man, absolutely.
Don't hurt yourself.
We'll wait for that one. No, the one I'm thinking of is Fella, which is directed by Bill T. Jones and has just been doing great on Broadway and deals with the story of the musician and hip-hop artist from Africa. And anyway, what's really cool is that the local group that is organized by Artur Silva, a great painter and printmaker, his group Cultural Cannibals is bringing a broadcast of the production of Fella from the National Theatre of London to the Toby at the IMA. So what they're doing is it's an HD production that will be screened on February 5th at 7 p.m. and tickets are available through Cultural Cannibals, and they are going fast from what I've heard, but it's a really cool way to, if you can't be there, at least to see what Fella is all about, again at the IMA, February 5th, 7 p.m. Check out culturalcannibals.com.
Go out early and walk through the Art and Nature Park. It's beautiful in the winter, too.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
Yes, it is.
Hey, speaking of dance, on a completely different note, on Saturday, February 5th, Indie Contra Dance is hosting the Mean Lids. It's a band.
Oh, cool. Okay.
They're from Urbana, Illinois. They play brewgrass. There's that beer again. Bluegrass,
uh-huh.
Swing, old-time Irish jug band, Cajun, country, western, rock, and classical. So even if you're not going to dance, you need to go hear Mean Lids just to see how they mix all those genres together. Again, that's Saturday, February 5th. It's Indie Contra Dance at the Earth House, and they're hosting the Mean Lids as their guest band, dancing from 8 to 11.
Cool. I want to hear some bluegrass, too.
Bluegrass.
Last thing I've got for our calendar this weekend is just a reminder, it is the Winter Magic Festival that's going on at the Indy Fringe Theater all weekend long, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, with performances all day, every day from five different great regional and national magic acts each and every day. Go to indyfringe.org for the full schedule, but look for me, I will be there.
I'd say something, but you made me disappear.
But I'm bummed. We'll be back next week with more of What Will We Do.
Yeah. You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
It's no secret that the new Palladium, the crown jewel of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, has held nearly 36 tuning concerts to help finesse its acoustics before this week's grand opening. Sharon Gamble wanted to know how a hall is tuned. So she took mobile equipment up to the Palladium and spoke with Damian Doria, partner, principal designer, and principal acoustician for Artec Consultants, a 40-year-old firm with scores of concert halls around the world to its credit.
Can you, in as much layman's terms as possible, walk me through what the moving pieces are in tuning a building?
Sure. Well, we have a number of different components in this room that are adjustable for acoustics, because the building has to accommodate a wide range of musical programming. It has to have a certain amount of adjustability within its acoustic. And the most visibly obvious one is the four-piece moving canopy that's comprised of glass and a steel space frame. and each of the four pieces can be moved up and down independently, and we can use that to tailor the balance of the musicians on stage as well as control how they project out into the auditorium.
And describe where that is.
That starts about seven rows out from the stage and extends all the way up to the other end of the stage where the organ is.
That's kind of this kind of canopy is kind of a signature piece for your company. I've gathered that you've kind of perfected this.
Well, ArtTech is well known for putting canopies into halls of this size and this sort of a configuration, although the glass and steel is unique to this space. A number of consultants before us, I think, made attempts at canopies that were somewhat small areas or small discs that were set up in sparse arrays. And we found by using larger pieces and covering more area that we get much better performance and control over how the sound behaves on stage.
What's the second most important element? This is my second tuning concert. I was here for the American Pianists Association concert, and I have to say I'm seeing a lot more curtains around the perimeter of the hall at this concert compared to that. How important is that element?
Well, the curtains are used mostly to control the overall loudness and reverberation in the room depending on the type of event. And as you were hearing earlier tonight, we were doing some amplified work, so we had about half the curtains extended out because it was something closer to an American Songbook type series work where there would be some amplification, but amplification isn't the main part of the event for the evening. There's still some natural sound coming off the stage. When we do something like the Wright Brothers this Friday for the Hard Hat concert, all the fabric will be extended into the room to control the sound from a heavily amplified event.
Now, obviously, one of the factors that you can't control at this stage of the game, but that will be controlled on a night-by-night basis, is the number of people in the hall will make a pretty big difference in the acoustics, right?
Absolutely. The audience presence in the room makes a very big difference. We used a very similar setting last night for the Carmel Symphony rehearsal as the one we had for the Indianapolis Symphony last week, but there was a difference of about 1,200 people in the room, and we learned quite a lot about what the change in the audience will do in that instance. In fact, we made a whole series of measurements last night to learn exactly what it would do.
So we've talked about the canopy, the adjustable canopy, the curtains. What are some of the other elements that can be changed or controlled?
Well, the staging itself is very flexible, and it can play a big part in how the musicians sound on stage, how they hear each other, and how they project into the room. The stage can be made longer by extending it out into the auditorium by three rows. We call that a four-stage extension. That same element can be lowered to a pit level if you have an event where you'd like to have an orchestra in the pit and activity on the stage. And there's also six rows of chorus behind the platform. And the first two rows, of course, are flexible. They can be removed from the stage or located as they are now.
Now, your firm got involved at the conceptual stage, right?
That's correct. We were involved in a very early programming study, which sort of led to a budget and a conceptual design for the auditorium itself. When David Schwarz was hired, we went into a much more thorough design of the auditorium and the building that would house it.
At one point in the murky past, there was this idea that the ideal concert hall is shoebox-shaped. We've left that concept back in the dust. You're looking like, oh, that was before I was born. I can't talk about that, right?
No, I was thinking it still is. This room very much is a shoebox. It has somewhat of a rounded end at both ends of the auditorium, but the concert hall itself is mostly rectangular. It's tall, has a lot of things in common with the shaping of a hall like Boston Symphony Hall or Musikvereinsaal in Vienna. The shoebox, in our opinion, is still the basic form of a concert hall.
It's good to know some things that hold true through the decades. So there is somewhere in this building, there is and there will be an ultimate control room where someone is going to be spending time at rehearsals. And where is that?
Oh, I don't know that it's any specific place. We have a lighting control booth just behind us where we're sitting here. There's a sound control booth on the opposite side from lighting. And on the stage, there's a stage management position which can control all the acoustic adjustable features.
And how many settings can there be?
Well, it's probably infinitely variable, but that would be an impractical way to approach it. We will probably present the center with a report recommending 4 to 6 settings for standard events, and they will make minor adjustments depending on what they expect for audience load, how large a particular ensemble might be, what sort of repertoire is being performed.
You know, with as sophisticated as these systems have become, it seems to me that some orchestras, some music directors in particular, might come in and say, well, you know, the Czech fill has a different sound than the New York fill, so we want our own customized settings. Has that happened in other halls? Is that something that is happening yet?
Absolutely. Every orchestra does have their own idea of how it should sound. And in fact, we find more than not, artistic directors aren't really interested in changing the sound of the room so much as they are deciding on a specific sound and sticking with it, even if they are doing a number of different types of works in a given evening. And I think that comes from many touring orchestras having to adjust the orchestra on stage to a different acoustic in every home that they come to. If they travel around the globe and play a number of different halls, they sort of adjust to those halls. Now, what we would do for a visiting orchestra like Cleveland would probably be different from what the St. Petersburg Orchestra would want.
How long is your relationship, or will your relationship be with this concert hall? Will you, the grand opening is on the horizon very soon. I imagine you're drawing close to a close on your initial work, but then you'll be back, yeah?
Well, we will. The city has sorted out an agreement for us to continue for a couple of seasons. But it's sort of like your children. Even once they've moved out, you don't really forget to talk to them and see how things are going. And every now and then they call you up for advice.
What possesses someone to do what you do? What was your first clue that you thought, oh, I could do this for a living?
Oh, well, I guess I'm really happy that I can do it for a living. I started out with a strong interest in music, and I went to the Hart School of Music and decided that as much as I enjoyed music, I probably wasn't as good a musician as I'd need to be to make a living at it, so I studied engineering and acoustics at the same time, and was very happy to find employment in the acoustics field, and probably because of the amount of work I did recording different ensembles in halls before I started working in the field of acoustics, I decided I had a big interest in how architectural acoustic worked and what I might be able to contribute to that field.
Are your ears insured?
Wow, that's an interesting question. They probably should be, but then I might not be able to listen to my iPod anymore.
See, yeah, that was my last question. What do you do to protect your own hearing, and what advice would you give to other people?
Well, given how much time I spend on airplanes, I often wear earplugs when I'm in sort of any kind of public transport that's very loud, but I do keep my iPod volume pretty low.
Words to the wise. We have a lot of young listeners. Thank you.
Sharon Gamble with Damian Doria, principal acoustician and designer with Artek Consultants. Learn more about the company and its halls around the world at artekconsultants.com. That's Artek, A-R-T-E-C, consultants.com. Learn more about the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts.org, or better yet, attend one of the many events going on in the next week during its grand opening.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll chat with director Janet Allen about the IRT's production of Diary of Anne Frank.
I'll find out what really happens at Girls' Night, the musical.
And I'll talk with artist Matthew Davey about his sculptures and paintings. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.